Silent Partners by Eugene Linden, 1986. Taped to the front of their cages were depictions of a number of Amislan signs and their meanings. "Oh, they sign all the time," he said. "That's why we put up the posters. The technicians kept seeing the chimps make these gestures, and they wanted to be able to respond." Only in the peaceable kingdoms of Art and Eden are the relationships between humans and animals innocent and harmonious. Here and now, they are complex, uneasy, often cruel, and always profound. City dwellers, seeing only people plus an occasional peak or pigeon, can pretend that nothing on earth matters but us. But if we want to eat or breathe, our dependence on non-human life is absolute and immediate, though mostly unexamined. When we use animals as work partners for food or in laboratories, the ethics of the relationship become both urgent and obscure. In the matter of the use of animals in laboratory experiments, some extremists confuse use with misuse and demand a total ban, while others justify means by ends and demand that atrocities be condoned. Eugene Linden has picked a particularly tangled but fascinating aspect of this difficult topic to explore in his third book about the apes used in language experiments. In the 70s, when ecology was considered something more than an obstacle to quick profits, experiments on the language capacities of animals were, as Linden points out, an apt expression of the generous and risk-taking temper of the times. They were attempts to cross boundaries. And they were greeted with excitement in part because they were conducted not as manipulations of a subject by an objective experimenter, but as partnerships. Language is not one-way communication, but essentially exchange. And to carry on the experiments, the individuals of two different species had to work together, to collaborate. Indeed, the teaching of language and the learning of it may go further than collaboration and require collusion. Ordinary discourse was characterized on our part by shameless cueing, outright prompting, and dubious interpretations of Gillian's gnomic, if not unintelligible, utterances. In fact, Gillian began to demonstrate most of the behaviors critics have cited as evidence that apes cannot learn language. She interrupted. She repeated phrases incessantly. She responded inappropriately. And she jumbled her word order. Gillian isn't a chimpanzee. She is Linden's then 18-month-old daughter. The point he is making is that normal human language acquisition is not a cool, methodical, detached affair, but an intensely felt enterprise involved essentially with relationship. Chimpanzees and gorillas, being sensitive creatures with notoriously strong emotional responses and attachments, it seems hardly surprising that the interesting, if maddeningly inconclusive results with regard to more complex uses of language came from experiments in which the ape had a relationship with the experimenter. Experiments in which the use of the language was a natural part of the animal's day. The experiments and criticisms, based on the assumption that an animal is a kind of machine, tried to eliminate emotional relationship and emotional reward from the attempt to find out if the ape brain could be programmed for language. Experiments such as the one that trained a chimp to express its wishes on a computer with food as reward for correct response have no more to do with language capacity than any animal circus act. But the temptation to use the stimulus response machine model is strong, because the only model we have for language use is the human one, and it is a very dangerous one. For how is the experimenter to avoid anthropomorphizing, carrying the analogy too far. Such questions mine the whole terrain and make for exciting travel in it. Eugene Linden knows the minefield well and guides us through it with intelligence and unfailing good humor. This last is an achievement in itself, for as the passage just quoted continues, it was from such experiments that the most extravagant claims for ape language use came. Experiments with the fewest controls and the most passionately committed experimenters. Thus, we had a situation bred perfectly for the most vituperative type of debate. And we got it. As he reports the vituperation, the increasing defensiveness of experimenters and bad faith of some critics, the sensationalism and sentimentalism of much media coverage, Linden's candor and fair-mindedness contrasts wonderfully with the prejudice and paranoia he describes. He does not pretend, however, to stand above the battle. His concern is ethical and urgent. For, after all the claims and counterclaims, now that we no longer see photographs of long, thumbless, inhuman hands signing friend in the language of the deaf, or read dismissive pronouncements from the lofty terraces of academic theory, now, in the mid-80s, what has become of the experimenters and their participants? Washu, Lucy, Nimchimpsky, Ali, Coco. Linden's answers to that question are all, to some degree, painful, and all extremely interesting, if only as tragic comic drama. Personality, both human and ape, is paramount from the first experiments to the last. Silent Partners is a great display of science as Snake Pit, and those who like the double helix can get the same evil glee from it. But the cost of these experiments and their repression may have been more than intellectual. It may be that the language-using chimps are suffering the consequences of having shown themselves before the world was ready to see them, and the scientists who trained them, the disgrace of having a good idea before the world was ready for it. Serious investigation of animal linguistic capacity has become almost impossible in the present climate. Funding for such investigation was cut off years ago. But the animal participants in the experiments were not only emotionally responsive, highly intelligent, sensitive, but also temperamental, non-domesticable, formidable creatures, neither pet nor wild. Rare, extremely valuable for medical experimentation, and expensive. So, when the experiments were closed down, what became of them? In some cases, the trainer has kept a relationship with the animal at the cost of career, and even of normal human relationships. Janice Carter took the chimpanzee Lucy, raised as a baby by a couple who gave her to the training center, to an island in an African river, where the woman must live in a cage while two groups of chimpanzees roam free. Trying to rid Lucy of her human dependence, Janice Carter will not use sign language with her. Washu and her trainer are keeping a low profile in the Pacific Northwest. Coco, the one gorilla involved in the first generation of language experiments, is still being zealously and jealously guarded by her trainer and interlocutor, Penny Patterson. The experiment is going on, but its results have been so selectively released that the most sympathetic scientist would have trouble defending Patterson's work against charges of incompetence or fraud. Without access to the evidence, it is easy to make such accusations and impossible to disprove them. This is an intellectual loss that may yet be made good, and at least Coco is as well off as she ever was. But Ali has vanished, nameless. into a maze of laboratories. Nim is in a kind of protective solitary confinement, and various lesser-known language-trained chimps are in the care of a tough-minded lab man, James Mahoney, of Lemsip Laboratories, who says, "Once you know that money is the determining factor, you know what is going to happen." So these days, the Centers for Disease Control can announce without excuse or comment that chimpanzees have been successfully infected with AIDS. From the point of view of these researchers, the success is complete. Older laboratory animals, having been subjected to previous experiments, even if the experiments were intellectual, not medical, are less valuable, hence appropriate for use in terminal studies. Mahoney, asking for a kind of retirement colony for the older animals, is in the minority. Most medical experimenters find destruction easier and cheaper. Indeed, one is tempted to think they save their imagination for inventing euphemisms. Lyndon's discussion of such difficult issues is exemplary. Only a prejudiced mind will accuse this book of bias or naivete. But probably some such accusations will be made, for some members of the scientific establishment react negatively to even the discussion of the possibility of language use by animals. That language, genuine language, including syntactics, jokes, lies, and disinterested or aesthetic observation, may prove to be a skill accessible in some degree to several species. This is an idea so distasteful to certain behaviorists and linguists that they attack not only the results of experiments, but the investigation of the subject. Academic territorialism plays a part in this tabooing, but its basis seems to be a need to believe in human uniqueness, human supremacy. Critics of this kind of speciesism suggests that it is about as useful to science as a need to believe that the sun goes around the earth. Lyndon may be unwise to call it humanism, as he does in his last paragraph, for that word has become the shibboleth of religious fundamentalists who, since they assert the God-ordained superiority of man over beast, would, in this usage, be humanists. The attitude of the human supremacist is expressed in a vocabulary very close to that of the male supremacist, and both positions probably rise from a terror of losing control of nature, defined as an object of human exploitation. That animals might exist independently as subjects capable of cognition, emotion, pain. This perception so threatens some alpha males of our species that, at any hint of it, they go into full aggression display, baring their canines, beating their chests, ignoring the evidence. These displays are undeniably impressive, if unedifying. Meanwhile, one is left with the unforgettable images of an animal inside a cage saying, "Drink, food, hurry," to a man outside the cage who doesn't know the language, and of a woman inside a cage refusing to talk to an animal outside the cage in the only language that animal knows. Such grotesque miseries bespeak a sickness of our times. Kind, quiet, and fair, Eugene Lyndon's book is both a diagnosis of and an antidote to the cruelty and confusion it describes. It is pleasant to hope that its success might be a sign of returning health. Note, Professor H.S. Terras sent me in October of 1986 a copy of a letter stating his strong opposition to Silent Partners and my review of it, and correcting two errors of fact. Professor Terras says that, quote, "Both David Premack and Dwayne Rumbaugh have reversed their originally positive assessments of an ape's grammatical competence. Yet both continue to be funded by significant federal grants, unquote, thus disproving my statement that serious investigation of animal linguistic capacity has become almost impossible in the present climate. Funding for such investigation was cut off years ago. It does seem interesting that the continued funding is for two researchers whose assessments of an ape's grammatical competence are negative. And Professor Terrace is justifiably annoyed at Lyndon's failure to check with him about Mim, who is not in solitary confinement, as I, following Lyndon, reported. Professor Terrace reports that, quote, since 1983, Nim has been housed with Sally, his mate, in a specially built, spacious home. I can attest personally that both appear to be happy and in good health.